between big capital for the billionaires, monopoly finance capital at the very top of the society and the lower middle class. The lower middle class is not anti-capitalist. They're basically opposed to what they see are what in the MAGA ideology is called the ruling class, mm-hmm. which is the professional managerial class, which is seen as controlling government. And they're also opposed to the working class, which they see as multi-ethnic and diverse and poverty-stricken and a population that they don't want to fall into. So the lower middle class is sort of the rear guard of the system. The billionaires have basically mobilized them, beginning with the Tea Party and then the Trump phenomenon, to turn the entire political system to the hard right, or into developing a neo-fascist movement of this kind, which has, of course, all sorts of contradictions.
John Bellamy Foster, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, editor of the Monthly Review, speaking to us from Washington State. His most recent piece, we'll link to at democracynow.org, called The Trump Doctrine and the New MAGA Imperialism. Happy birthday to Christine Marr. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and Oregon Country Fair, July 11th through the 13th in Vineta. Fairgoers experience a celebration of art, music, and family on 17 stages in a wooded setting. No tickets will be sold on site. Tickets and information at OregonCountryFair.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's cherry harvest is being affected by Trump's anti-immigration policies. Caregivers in Portland Hospital recently voted to unionize. And Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov brings us the International Global Citizen Report. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 8, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. More than 1,100 caregivers at a Portland hospital voted recently to unionize, joining Service Employees International Union Local 49. Catherine Carley has more on the story.
More than 1,100 caregivers at Portland's Providence St. Vincent Medical Center have voted to unionize, joining the Service Employees International Union, Local 49. Hospital staffers, including certified nursing assistants, cooks, lab assistants, pharmacy techs, environmental workers, and patient representatives, will soon begin collective bargaining with management over a new work contract. New union member Finn McCool works in the hospital's food service department and says changes to working conditions conditions in the hospital were a major driver to organize.
There's a lot that makes St. Vincent a great place to work, but we've also seen just tons of changes over the years around staffing and benefits. So my fellow caregivers really knew that jobs were only going to get harder.
The St. Vincent caregivers will join thousands of other unionized workers at Providence hospitals in Oregon, Washington State, and other parts of the country. Providence officials released a statement recognizing the union and saying they were prepared to work with it toward a new contract. McCool says the company made several changes to staffing and work policies without feedback from its employees. He says changes to the employees' health care benefits caused a major upheaval.
There's been a recent change to our health care plan with Aetna switching over, and that was probably a very large reason why a lot of us decided to vote yes. We had our own internal health care system. We changed to a different thing. Co-pays changed. Things were definitely a lot harder with increased deductibles.
McCool says political uncertainty, particularly in the government healthcare policies, was also a significant concern.
We're seeing a lot of changes going on with our government with cuts, especially right now. What threatens us is cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. Our CEO said these cuts are threatening the hospital.
I'm Catherine Carley for Oregon News Connection. Original reporting by Mark Richardson.
Oregon's fruit harvest is at risk because of Donald Trump's immigration policies. Cherry farmers are in particular experiencing difficulties. Some farms are seeing the arrival of fewer than half the expected number of workers. Trump's immigration enforcement efforts are keeping many California-based migrants, who usually travel to harvest in a variety of areas, from coming north to Oregon and Washington. Farmers across the Pacific Northwest are concerned with a limited labor pool that could put some out of business and leave fruit unpicked and rotting in the fields. In June, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents targeted workers picking blueberries and packing produce in California. Farmers are concerned that if their workforce comes from an area where ICE raids are taking place, they will lose both migrant and seasonal farm workers. The cherry harvest season is particularly brief, and cherries need to be picked quickly. Hundreds or more tons of fruit are at risk. It's not just domestic migrant workers from California who are unavailable. Seasonal foreign farm workers our farmers obtained visas for under the federal H-2A agricultural program are getting held up at the border in Mexico. That program allows agricultural employees who anticipate a shortage of domestic workers to hire temporary foreign farm workers. Last year, about 4,200 workers obtained H-2A visas to work at Oregon sites. Staffing shortages at the U.S. consulate in Tijuana are probably making things worse. Once the federal government reviews an application, it normally schedules an interview with the worker at the consulate office, usually within a week. There have been recent 3 and even 4 week delays in that scheduling. The federal government also seems to be asking for more information before it can approve some applications. Workers' applications and their previous histories are being scrutinized. Trump, as he has done with tariffs, has sent mixed signals on potential immigration enforcement in industries like agriculture and hospitality. He recently effected a pause on workplace raids in those areas, but soon after walked back on that order. FEMA's fate remains up in the air as flooding ravages Texas. Trump again threatens aggressive tariffs, and the U.S. Supreme Court considers a consequential campaign finance case. With that story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The president wants to ensure American citizens always have what they need during times of need. Whether that assistance comes from states or the federal government, that's a policy discussion that will continue.
Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says the White House may back away from dismantling the Federal Emergency Management Agency and giving its role to the states. The death toll from catastrophic flooding in central Texas is now over 80, and officials there say they're overwhelmed without federal assistance. Some also blame cuts to the Weather Service for delaying storm warnings. President Donald Trump hammered FEMA after deadly storms in North Carolina and falsely claimed money from the agency was given to undocumented immigrants. He also said he might withhold fire aid for California to force policy changes there. But on Sunday, he approved disaster funding for Texas. In a new trade stance, Trump says 12 countries will see higher tariffs August 1st unless they reach a deal with the U.S. He's specifically threatening to impose 25% import taxes on South Korea and Japan. Stocks tumbled following the announcements, and Texas Democratic Congressman Lloyd Doggett slammed Trump on MSNBC for the trade chaos.
It is incredibly amazing that this president, who promised us 90 deals in 90 days after starting a trade war, cannot admit his failure.
The Supreme Court says it will consider lifting restrictions on how much money political parties can spend in coordination with a candidate for federal office. As watchdogs prepare to argue the case, Hillary Brasseth, with Open Secrets, warns it could lead to even more money being spent on elections.
If this court case does rule in favor of removing caps, I do think that it's highly likely that we will continue to see the cost of elections increasing, bearing in mind that over the last several years, that overall price tag has continued to be on the rise.
Ohio lawmakers are considering an elections bill that would enact sweeping changes to voting and ballot measures. Senate Bill 153 outlines a process for challenging a voter's use of government ID to prove their citizenship, and supporters say it's needed for election security. Mia Lewis of Common Cause Ohio says it would stop legitimate votes and make it much tougher to get ballot initiatives before voters.
It makes the entire process of a citizen-initiated ballot measure so much harder unnecessarily. It allows more signatures to be thrown out for clerical errors.
Multiple states have enacted rules requiring voters in federal elections to prove they are citizens, even though non-citizen voting is already illegal and all but never happens. Opponents also warn adding election red tape will cause confusion and disenfranchisement. A new Gallup poll finds fewer than 6 in 10 U.S. adults say they're proud to be American, a record low. Independents and Democrats experience sizable declines in national pride. In a step that's sparking outrage and disbelief in parts of the internet, the Justice Department says sex offender Jeffrey Epstein died by suicide and did not keep a so-called client list. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview from KBOO's Lisa Loving with Reporters Without Borders. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 89 degrees and a low of 58. And tomorrow it will be a high of 75 and a low of 57. Today in history, in 1914, labor activist and singer Joe Hill was convicted of murder on meager evidence and sentenced to death in Utah. Scholars have since debated whether he was guilty or framed because of his radical politics. The quote of the day is Joe Hill's last-minute message. Don't waste any time in mourning. Organize. President Donald Trump is proposing drastic funding cuts for tribal colleges and universities. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Trump is proposing drastic funding cuts for tribal colleges and universities. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more on institutions in Arizona and New Mexico.
Without doubt, this is threatening to close their doors.
Anna Wake Rose is Cherokee. She's president and CEO of the nonprofit American Indian Higher Education Consortium. These schools depend on three federal agencies to stay financially afloat.
If you take away any one of those legs, that stool will fall. And we actually saw flat funding at both the Department of Education and USDA.
As for the Interior Department,
ironically, the agency that's really in charge of the trust responsibility to Indian people is the one that zeroed out funding.
The White House did not respond to KJZZ's request when asked to explain why. But Scott Davis, who is Standing Rock Sioux and senior advisor to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, testified during a congressional hearing that these huge cuts are nothing new.
We've been through the ebbs and flows of funding with Congress for a long time. We've seen cuts, we've seen increases, we've seen it all, but we've always been resilient.
Fauna Offam Community College President Stephen Schoonmaker worries this is nothing short of a death sentence.
Some tribal colleges will die quickly and others will die slowly, but we cannot sustain without the obligated funds that should be coming and have come for a long time.
While the community college is home to nearly 1,200 students with four campuses statewide, Schoonmaker says they are still dependent on the feds. More than half of its operational funding comes from the Bureau of Indian Education. He fears funding shortfalls could have cascading effects, like losing their accreditation, which took years to achieve.
Our accreditor is going to say, are you fiscally stable? And if you aren't, they're just going to look at that as a red flag.
And the looming cuts could discourage student interest, with Schoonmaker saying the mere threat hurts enrollment.
Why would a student say, I'm going to go to Tonawanda Community College, when they may lose 90% of a major funding source?
In Santa Fe, the Institute of American Indian Arts is bracing for the Trump administration to do away with its $13 million appropriation.
They've never given us a reason. Didn't expect this one, though.
President Robert Martin, who is Cherokee, never imagined his summer being bogged down by grave budget talks before retiring later this month. Now it's up to lawmakers in D.C. to decide the fate of this prestigious art school in the Southwest.
In our name, it has Indian and arts, and both of those I don't think are considered to be very important to this current administration.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Leaders of Native organizations and tribes are speaking out against conservative commentator Ann Coulter's recent post on X, which she stated, quote, "We didn't kill enough Indians," with a photo of a Native professor. Native American Rights Fund Executive Director John Echohawk, in a statement Monday, called the post ignorant and immoral and genocidal language, while Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. shared a long response on Facebook, calling the post beyond abhorrent and dangerous hate speech. The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs has scheduled a hearing this month to consider the nomination of William Kirkland for Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in the Department of the Interior. Kirkland, who's Navajo, is a political strategist from Georgia and served in the first Trump administration. The National Congress of American Indians applauded his nomination earlier this year, stating the position is critical to upholding the federal government's trust and treaty responsibilities and ensuring the effective delivery of services to tribes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
On July 2nd, Donald Trump sent the first group of newly detained immigrants to the newly constructed, quote, Alligator Alcatraz Immigration Detention Center deep in the Everglades of Florida. This is on the heels of President Trump, Secretary of Homeland Security Kristen Noem, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis making their highly publicized tour of the facility before the detained immigrants were set to arrive. The facility will cost American taxpayers $450 million a year. It was built at the direction of President Trump as part of his retaliation against United States immigrants and immigration laws. The detention center takes on the name from the local reptile population and the famed federal penitentiary in the San Francisco Bay. Alligator Alcatraz is considered a state-of-the-art detention facility to some, which was built in just 8 days. To others, it is a bleak existence in an unknown world that was built on top of an old airport training facility. The detention center features more than 200 security cameras, almost 100 baseball stadiums' length of barbed wire, and 400 security personnel. The facility can hold a capacity of about 5,000 detainees. Democratic lawmakers in Florida headed to the Alligator Alcatraz on July 3rd, citing concerns about the conditions for detainees and the millions of dollars that were awarded for the construction of the site. The Florida lawmakers, Democratic Representatives Anna Eskamani, Angie Nixon, and Michelle Rayner, along with Democratic Senators Shervin Jones and Carlos Guillermo Smith, were all denied entry to the facility after the first immigrant inmates arrived on Wednesday, July 2nd, the day after Trump's tour. They were denied entry due to, quote, safety concerns. Trump toured the concentration camp on July 1st, stating, quote, Biden wanted me in here, okay, it didn't work out that way, but he wanted me in here, end quote. In the hours between President Trump's visit to the facility and the attempts by Democratic leaders to visit the facility, the construction started to show its flaws. After President Trump left the facility in the Everglades, a strong storm system came through the area of the facility and caused flooding that went under the chain-linked cages where the bunks were, ripped holes in the new roof, and exposed electrical cables. The facility is supposedly rated by the state to withstand a Category 2 hurricane with winds up to 120 miles an hour. Senator Shervin Jones addressed his inability to enter the facility in a post on X on July 3rd. He said, quote, Florida law gives legislators the authority to make unannounced visits to state-run facilities to inspect conditions and check on the well-being of the people inside. I've served in the legislature for 13 years, and this has never happened, end quote. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, is using new technology in its crusade to detain illegal immigrants in the United States. ICE has started using mobile phone apps that can identify suspects based on their fingerprints or by simply pointing a smartphone camera at a person's face. According to internal ICE emails, the mobile Fortify app is the system they are using to facially recognize people. And the facial technology is ordinarily used when people enter or exit the U.S., but is now being used in the field to identify potential targets without using secondary collection devices. Though officers are often reminded that fingerprint matching is the most accurate biometric indicator available in the application, one former ICE agent who requested anonymity says, quote, We used the EDI app, which is fingerprint-based but would generate images. This technology has been around for 15 or more years, end quote. It's not just fingerprints anymore. Photos can be used. It pulls from internal databases. President Trump has vowed that he would deport millions of undocumented immigrants as part of his mass deportations across the country. The Trump administration's continued willingness to use sophisticated technology in its efforts to round up those whom it deems illegal in the United States only gives ICE the ability to boost the quotas they are being forced to meet daily. The document also highlights how biometrics can be built for one reason and used for another. Civil liberty groups have consistently spoken out against the use of such tools against the population. Nathan Fried-Wessler, deputy director of the ACLU, says that, quote, Face recognition technology is notoriously unreliable, frequently generating false matches and resulting in a number of known wrongful arrests across the country. Immigration agents relying on this technology to try to identify people on the street is a recipe for disaster. Congress has never authorized DHS to use facial recognition technology in this way, and the agency should shut this dangerous experiment down, end quote. Climate solutions are more popular than you might think. Fossil fuel PR campaigns have misled people into believing that climate solutions are more controversial than they actually are. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Research shows that most Americans are worried about global warming, and there is widespread support for climate solutions and policies, like taxing companies for the carbon pollution they emit and transitioning to clean energy.
The reality is a vast majority of Americans want action on climate change. We want solar energy and wind turbines.
But Philip Newell of the Climate Action Against Disinformation Coalition says many people do not realize this. He says one reason is that fossil fuel companies have led lobbying efforts and PR campaigns that make people think climate solutions are more controversial than they actually are.
It makes you think, oh, it's not popular, and so we shouldn't be loud and vocal and proudly advocating for climate solutions.
He says sowing doubt about the popularity of climate action can make people nervous to publicly support clean energy, to advocate for climate policies, or even to talk about climate change with friends.
Like you're going to get yelled at if you talk about it, when in reality, you can be very confident talking about climate change with most of your friends and neighbors because it is 60, 70, 80% of Americans that are supporting these issues. So not being afraid, not being bullied by the disinformation is one way they can start to push back.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
In energy policy, the U.S. and China are moving in opposite directions, the one banking on fossil fuels, the other on renewables. China's energy model, which includes exports of green technologies, is rapidly gaining adherence. Trump's withdrawal of subsidies to renewables is ceding the future to Beijing. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. When it comes to energy planning, China and the United States are moving in opposite directions with major consequences for our future. As the New York Times reported on July 1, quote, the Trump administration wants to keep the world hooked on fossil fuels like oil and gas, which have powered cars and factories, warmed homes, and fueled empires for more than a century. The U.S. is the world's largest producer of oil and the largest exporter of natural gas, offering the potential for what Mr. Trump has called an era of American energy dominance that eliminates dependence on foreign countries, particularly rivals like China. China is racing in an altogether different direction. It's banking on a world that runs on cheap electricity from the sun and wind, and that relies on China for affordable, high-tech solar panels and turbines. China leads the world in both. Unlike the United States, the Times goes on, China doesn't have much easily accessible oil or gas of its own relative to its huge population. So it is eager to eliminate dependence on imported fossil fuels and instead power more of its economy with renewables. It's important to note that each country's primary motivation in energy policy is national security, not concern about climate change. Trump's quest for energy dominance has led to permits for drilling just about everywhere, most recently opening up huge areas of the Tongass and other national forests, in complete disregard for environmental concerns. Essentially, Trump is subsidizing the fossil fuel industries. Xi Jinping also wants to avoid dependence on foreign sources of energy, an aim underscored when Iran, a major supplier of oil for China, came under attack. But the Chinese are very conscious of how its continuing reliance on coal harms public health and the environment, sometimes causing local protests. Thus, we have China's large and growing lead in energy technologies. China's global manufacturing of solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, EVs, and many other clean energy industries. The Trump administration is busily cutting subsidies to those very industries. China holds the hammer over the United States and all other countries in its dominant position in the mining and processing of rare earth minerals. You can't operate wind turbines, drive an EV, or produce any advanced technology without those minerals. Although China has promised to smooth applications for rare earth magnets, its commerce ministry is taking its time and taking passports away from its rare earth experts to prevent sharing of trade secrets. Both countries are exporting their energy models, the U.S. by trying to persuade customers, most recently Japan and, yes, China, to buy American oil. China by winning over developing countries with green energy technologies, such as Saudi Arabia. For example, China leads the world by a large margin in exports of lithium-ion batteries, EVs, and solar panels, while the U.S. is far ahead of China in exports of oil and natural gas. Finally, China's lead over the U.S. is growing in nuclear power. China has 24 nuclear plants in operation and over 100 under construction. Its nuclear power capacity puts China third behind the U.S. and France, but not for long. China has also announced advances in next-generation nuclear technologies and also in fusion, the long-promised source of all but limitless clean energy that has bedeviled science for years, says the Times. China's energy advantage has been shaped by the organization of work. Robotics plays an increasingly important role in factories. Cluster manufacturing brings all the elements of production together. As one Chinese solar panel manufacturer says, quote, "There are places where, within a 3 to 4 hour drive, you can have everything. The components, the manufacturer, the skilled workforce, everything. There's nowhere else globally where you can have all that innovation clustered together," unquote. And the scale of operations is staggering. Huge solar power arrays and EV factories, for instance. Compare that with Trump's cuts in renewables, which means ghost factories and hundreds of thousands of jobs lost. One thing both countries have in common is leaders who put production ahead of protection. Trump has eliminated hundreds of environmental protection regulations, undermining a record that spans 50 years. But public health clearly has very low priority under Trump. Air and water pollution in China and forest destruction have a long history. The breakneck speed of China's production of clean energy technologies, from mining to factory, probably has come at considerable cost to worker safety and health. Is there any question about which country will dominate the energy future? The U.S. will champion a fossil fuel economy, and China will become the leader of the low-carbon economy, said Li Shuo, who heads the China Climate Hub at the Asia Society Policy Institute. The question for the U.S. now, he said, is where do you go from here? The rational answer would be back to the future, by defeating Trump's drill baby drill agenda and restoring all the green energy and environmental protection programs that he has eviscerated. If opinion polls are correct, that answer has the American public's strong support. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971 971- 1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, James Kemp, and Mel Gertov. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and Zamon Perez. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth with Lisa Loving.
I'm Lisa Loving with the Pacifica Radio Network. Reporters Without Borders is an international organization tracking violence against journalists around the world. This week, they spoke out against attacks on reporters in Los Angeles covering the Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids against workers there. We're speaking with Clayton Weimers. He's the executive director of Reporters Without Borders USA, which is based in Washington, D.C. And thanks for being here, Clayton.
Thank you for having me.
What's going on in Los Angeles right now, and what's happening to reporters on the scene?
Well, I think folks have been able to follow along as protests on the ground have really taken root in Los Angeles and many other cities around the country in response to the Trump administration's immigration raids. But what has maybe gotten a little bit less attention amid all the chaos on the streets is how much violence has been unleashed against the journalists who are trying to tell us about what's happening on the ground. It's been pretty shocking. We haven't seen this level of violence against journalists in the United States since really the height of the Black Lives Matter protest movement.